Stephen Hawking once said, "We are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star, but we can understand the universe, and that makes us very special." Yes, we are very special indeed. Hi there, everybody. Welcome to episode number 448 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. First off, I must apologize ahead of time this week. I have been laid out with bronchitis all week, so my voice is not what it normally is. So, raspy voice aside, what have I got cooked up for you this week? Just a little trip to space, that's all. My guest is Helmut Puchner from Infineon, and we're talking about a new space-qualified serial interface FRAM. Why this new technology is more energy efficient than other devices used for space applications, and what kind of advantages we're looking at when it comes to using a 2 megabyte serial interface FRAM versus other memory devices in space applications. But before we bring in Helmut, it's time for a little news you may have missed. Did you hear about the discovery of a hidden trove of black holes? Just hiding in plain sight? So get this. A team of researchers from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have discovered a treasure trove of massive black holes in dwarf galaxies. And the discovery of these black holes could help us unravel the mysteries surrounding the life story of the supermassive black hole at the center of our own galaxy. Okay, let's step back a second. How does one detect black holes in the first place? Well, most often they are detected when they are actively growing by ingesting the stardust and gas around them, which makes them glow very intensely. Think fireflies. We only really see them when they're glowing, right? But this kind of detection is problematic, because a lot like growing black holes, young newborn stars can also glow with that same kind of high-energy radiation. Before this recent study by this team at UNC Chapel Hill, astronomers would have differentiated a new star formation from a growing black hole by using a series of diagnostic tests that relied on detailed features of each galaxy's visible light when spread out into a spectrum. And it was this traditional approach that actually led to this new discovery. Because when this team attempted to apply these tests to galaxy survey data, something didn't add up. This team discovered that some of the galaxies they were studying were sending mixed messages. While two tests would seem to indicate growing black holes, another would say star formation. UNC Chapel Hill professor Sheila Kanapan, co-author of this study, explains it like this. She says, previous work had just rejected ambiguous cases like these from statistical analysis, but I had a hunch they might be undiscovered black holes in dwarf galaxies. It was this professor's idea that it was actually that third test that was key here. It was her suspicion that the third test was actually more sensitive than the other two to typical properties of dwarf galaxies, including their simple elemental composition and the high rate of forming new stars. So a new census of growing black holes began, keeping both the traditional and mixed message type of black holes in mind. This team developed two new kinds of surveys to determine the type of black holes they were seeing. And get this, more than 80% of the growing black holes this team discovered belong to this new type. Mugda Polimera, lead author of this study and UNC Chapel Hill PhD student, explains this aspect of their research like this. "We got all nervous. The first question that came to my mind was, Have we missed a way that extreme star formation alone could explain these galaxies? But after Mugda extensively searched for alternate explanations, including exotic astrophysics, modeling uncertainties, and star formation, the team was forced to conclude that these newly identified black holes were in fact real. Professor Kanapan sums up their research like this. We're still pinching ourselves. We're excited to pursue a zillion follow-up ideas. The black holes we've found are the basic building blocks of supermassive black holes like the one in our own Milky Way. There's so much we want to learn about them. And if you want to learn even more information about this National Science Foundation-funded research by UNC Chapel Hill, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page on eejournal.com. All right, it's time to bring in Helmut and talk all about space-qualified serial interface EFRAM. Let's go.
Hi, Helmut. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning.
So I heard that Infineon just announced the first space-qualified serial interface EFRAM with 2 megabytes density. Now, Helmut, how does this differ from previous devices similar to this for space applications in particular?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Just give you a little bit background on this technology. So this ferroelectric technology is actually around for about, I would say, 20 years and has been researched a lot in the last 20 years. And it's really the specific material characteristics of this ferroelectric memory that allows us to issue this device now for space applications. The ferroelectric memory, you can envision it basically as a capacitor with some PCT dipoles between the two plates of the capacitor. And when you apply electric field, you turn those little dipoles either up or down. And as you can see from this explanation, it's actually a fairly simple memory and it's a non-volatile memory. So basically, once you remove the electric field, the dipoles stay in this position. So this is a fundamental physical effect that allows us to issue a non-volatile memory. Now, in the space environment, we have, of course, very sophisticated particles that hit the semiconductors. And everybody heard about solar flares. Recently, Starlink was very prominent in the news because they lost 40 satellites. Interesting enough, it was not because electronics failure, it was protons kind of stirred up the outer atmosphere and that caused additional drag on the satellites. But in space, you have a huge abundance of particles that hit the semiconductors. And those particles are typically charged particles. So either protons, electrons, and they can cause interaction with the semiconductor. And this particular ferroelectric memory is not susceptible to any of those interactions. So the ferroelectric memory cell is what we call radiation hardened and radiation immune. So that's the fundamental behavior of this memory that makes it attractive for space applications. Now, why did it take so long to issue this part for space? Is really we wanted to issue the right part for the right application. And this particular 2 megabit ferroelectric memory is the first one in the industry that has a SPI interface. So this is a serial protocol. And serial protocols in the last decade, I would say, they're gaining a lot of attraction because with only a couple handful of pins, you can operate an external memory versus the legacy interface is basically a parallel interface where you spend at least, I would say, 45 to 50 pins. And on this particular memory, we need really, in reality, only 7 pins to connect the memory. So as you can see, this is very, very efficient. And nowadays, with a lot of compressed information and compressed architectures, processors, microcontrollers, FPGAs, all those, I would call them computational units in the system, they are all pin limited because system engineers, they want to solve so many problems at the same time. And we don't have enough computational power. We don't have enough pins. This is really helping the industry to reduce the pin count for specific functions and gives you a very easy way to offload some of the memory from the processing unit to the external FRAM device.
Helmut, how are these more energy efficient than other devices used for space applications in this category?
So if you look at typically in this category, we have E-squared PROM devices. So those are basically polysilicon gates that you tunnel charge into it. So it's a different mechanism. So you're storing charge in a reservoir and you're draining charge out of a reservoir. And those typically require higher power to program as well as to erase. Now, they also require higher voltages to program and erase. And that's a very dangerous proposition in space. Why? Because higher voltages require thicker dielectric materials and gate oxide materials to allow the operation at higher voltage. And there's one effect in space, it's called the total ionizing dose, or TID, which is strictly proportional to the thickness of the dielectric. So the thicker the dielectric, the worse the TID effect. And it's basically particles or ionizing rays hitting the silicon dielectric and storing charge there. So the effect of TID is that the leakage currents will increase, and it can lead to effects like the charge pumps you need to generate these high voltages will be failing. The charge pumps are really critical in high voltage circuits, and once they fail, you cannot program an erase anymore. So that's why our technology has a big advantage, because as I explained before, it's strictly a capacitor, and we program at about 2 volts only. So compared to the E-squared PROM that can program up to 20, 25 volts. So you can see we have almost a 10x lower programming voltage here. And that's a big advantage. And it also gives you a large power savings because you don't have to continuously fire up the pumps and maintain those. Also, from the type of programming, if I compare an E-squared PROM and our FRAM technology, as I explained before, the FRAM technology can easily be programmed by reverting an electric field on the plates of the capacitor. In the E-squared PROM, you have to inject either electron or holes into the storage reservoir. Now, the fundamentals here is that whenever you inject carriers through a dielectric, then you have damage to the dielectric. So we call it increased gate leakage and a reliability wear-out mechanism. So that results in a limited endurance. And endurance is basically one program erase cycle. The E-squared PROM devices typically can deliver in space between 1,000 to maybe 10,000 endurance cycles. So in other words, you can program or write data to the memory only 10,000 times over the life, where our FRAM technology can be written to 10 trillion times. So that's 10 to the power of 13. We can almost write to the memory every single cycle. So that's a main advantage. And from an application standpoint, that makes our FRAM device the perfect data logger. Basically, you have a system that fulfills some function in space on the satellite, and it has sophisticated instrumentation or something that needs to be calibrated, adapted to the local environment. And if you have critical calibration data that you don't want to repeat all the time, the calibration again, you just want to keep the last calibration and the best calibration, you keep it safe, then you write it to our ferroelectric memory as many times as you want, and you can keep those safe in the memory. And when the power goes out because you lose your batteries, because you're going into the shade of Earth or something, then those data are preserved. When the power comes back, you can start right away with the latest calibration. You don't have to worry about wear leveling. That's the term that system architects were using in the past, because one E-squared PROM is not sufficient enough. They add a couple of them and then switch between them to basically get a longer lifetime and endurance cycling. So you don't need that for our FRAM devices. They are good to go for the life of the product.
Okay, so specifically, let's look at advantages here. Now, Helmut, what do you think the advantages are of using your 2 megabit serial interface FRAM versus other memory devices in space applications?
So we talked already about the low pin count. So that's still a given. We selected for space application the smallest ceramic package that I'm aware of. It's a 10 by 8 millimeter, 16 lead ceramic SOP device. That's one advantage. The second one is the low pin count connectivity to the system that allows to process and store data in a non-volatile memory through the SPI interface. We're running here at 25 megahertz, which is a decent frequency that most of the E2 PROM devices cannot hit in space. And power consumption is extremely beneficial. So we're talking here of a typical operating current in the single-digit milliamp range between 2 to 3 milliamps and standby currents in the microamp range. So these are very important and battery-operated systems like a satellite. They're all battery-operated at some point, right? And then I would say the endurance is one of the biggest advantages because we have 10 trillion cycles versus typically 1,000 or maximum 10,000 cycles.
All right, Helmut, it is time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, a lot of us can't have our most favorite foods due to some kind of issue, whether it's travel, lockdown, or the restaurants closed. So if you could have one meal right now, Helmut, what would you have?
That's a tricky question because I come from a country that has a huge culture on pastry. So if you ever been to Austria or Vienna and ever been in a coffee house there, you will find basically a counter with like 20 or 30 different types of cakes and torts. So one of my favorite is still hard to get because you have to ship it over. And, you know, once it's in transit for a couple of days, it doesn't taste that well. It's a Sacher Torte. I'm not sure whether you ever had it, but there is a hotel behind the opera house in Vienna, and the name is Hotel Sacher. And they established themselves in the Emperor's time as the prime dinner place in Vienna, right? And their signature dessert is a Sacher Torte. So it's basically a chocolate cake with apricot jam and a chocolate covering. That's typically my favorite. And you have to take it with a spoon of whipped cream, of course.
Of course.
Because chocolate is not enough.
That sounds absolutely amazing. Please sign me up right now, Helmut. Awesome. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EE Journal TFM. And don't forget, if you would like to follow my personal Twitter account, check out Amelia D 1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, you can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by, who's that? Yeah, me. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help. Also, if you'd like any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's A-M-E-L-I-A, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of June 3rd, 2022, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.